The World Series is over, the 2017 baseball season is history, and yet, how is it we still find ourselves lost in the infinite inning? There are two answers to that. The first is that the infinite inning, the show, will persist straight on through the hot stove season and into next season for as long as there's breath in my body to do it and your willingness to listen. As for the infinite inning, the concept, that's eternal. For those who are new to the show, the infinite inning is that turning point in life when the bases are loaded with two outs and no matter what pitch you throw, you can't get that third batter retired. This applies not just to baseball, but to many situations in life, and it knows no season. It knows no specific situation. It can strike you at any time, and the condition can be chronic. The trick at that point, the really, really difficult trick, is to then find a way of accepting that you may not ever get that third out while simultaneously knowing deep inside that you will keep trying, that you will not surrender. I'm still trying to figure that one out myself. It's hard. The World Series just passed had its share of infinite innings. So many pitchers used starting pitchers notoriously disappeared from games much faster than at any time in history. Some of that is no doubt correlated to the sheer number of home runs that were hit. Looking at World Series Game 2, 11 innings, 9 pitchers used, 4 home runs allowed. And that's just the Dodgers. If you add in the Astros, that's another 5 pitchers and another 4 home runs. Then again, ALDS Game 4, Indians and Yankees. The Indians only allowed 1 home run in 8 innings, but nonetheless used 8 pitchers. Terry Francona went from his starter, Trevor Bauer, to Joe Smith, Mike Clevenger, Danny Salazar, Tyler Olson, Brian Shaw, Cody Allen, and Josh Tomlinson. And you know what? They mostly did a good job. They lost anyway. You might remember in the aforementioned World Series Game 2, David Roberts yanked Rich Hill after 4, and then went to Kenta Maeda, Tony Watson, Ross Stripling, Brandon Morrow, Kenley Jansen, Josh Fields, Tony Cingrani, and finally, Brandon McCarthy. And these are not only infinite innings in the literal sense of the term, they're also almost metaphorical infinite innings in the way that we talk about it here on the program, because these managers often found that no matter who they went to, it just didn't work. Brandon Morrow gave up a run. Kenley Jansen, who's usually invulnerable, blew a save. They were pushing all these guys out of their usual roles, and when they didn't perform, say in this game, Kenley Jansen pitched 2 innings and threw 29 pitches, and that's a lot for him. His high for the season, I believe, was 33, which he got to a couple of times, but generally he was much lower than that. And whereas our regular season model of bullpen and closer use is, I believe, fundamentally flawed, to ask pitchers to then go to October and start doing things that you've never asked them to before, and in particular, to achieve feats of endurance that they're not conditioned to achieve or practiced in achieving, is foolhardy, and it will blow up on you more often than not. There's a myth here that players will rise to the occasion, and of course sometimes they do. There's no 100%. There's no certainty about anything. But on the whole, I think it courts injury, and it courts disaster. We always say, dance with the one that brung ya. Well, dance with the tactics that brung ya. The way those pitching changes often turned out, new pitcher, boom, over the wall, new pitcher, boom, over the wall, reminded me of the Battle of Jutland, which was the one big naval battle of the First World War. It took place on May 31st to June 1st, 1916, and it was between the British and the Germans. The whole thing is kind of an anticlimax in a way, because prior to the war, in the 10 years prior, the British and the Germans had engaged in this big naval arms race. The British were obviously the world's great sea power with an empire that spanned the globe. The way they projected their power throughout that empire was with their ships. And this goes back to the 18th century and ships made of wood. Now they're made of steel and they have giant guns on them that can lob projectiles from a distance of 6 miles out. And the Germans wanted to be in on that too. And it was a problem for them because their access to the Atlantic came basically through the North Sea, which is kind of a British lake. So they start building more and more technologically advanced battleships, and the British respond by building more technologically advanced battleships. These were called dreadnoughts. And they're really impressive, and they're kind of cool until the airplane comes along in World War II and demonstrates that they're now more or less obsolete. Kind of depressing in a way, if you're at all romantic about big armored ships. The Germans knew that they couldn't catch up to the British in terms of the amount of steel they had floating on the water, but they figured that the British would always be distracted because of that empire. They'd always be sending ships off, and they'd never be able to mass their whole fleet against the Germans. If the Germans just had a representative fleet and inflicted a lot of damage, that would balk the British because they not only would have to keep up their naval superiority locally, but everywhere, and they just couldn't spare that kind of capacity. The Germans could then go on doing whatever they wanted to do in terms of projecting their own power into the oceans. This turned out to be wrong on several levels, one of them having nothing to do with military tactics and a lot to do with human sentimentality. Their king, Kaiser Wilhelm II, really liked the Navy. I mean, in a not quite healthy way. He was Queen Victoria's grandson, and he spent time visiting her, and when he did, they'd take him down to the docks and show him all the British naval power, and I don't think that was just because boys liked boats, but maybe they were trying to say, look, we know you might end up running Germany one day, and look, don't mess with us, because we got the goods here. But that wasn't the message that got across. Wilhelm was not thinking, boy, am I intimidated. What he was thinking was, I want that. I want a navy of my own. They gave him a pretend admiral's uniform, and he never stopped wearing it. As he got older, he just kept going out on the sea on his yacht and pretending to be an admiral, and not just in the German navy. He had costume changes for most of the world's big navies. Who are you today, your highness? I am Admiral Dewey at the Battle of Manila Bay. Very good, your highness. And by the way, we'll be having chocolate pudding at lunch today. Oh, boy! This is an adult male in his 40s we're talking about. The problem is, once you have your bathtub navy, and you really, really like it, you get scared to use it because you might scratch them. So, the Germans had this wonderful thing called the High Seas Fleet, but they still had fewer big battleships than the British, and so, for the most part, they were all dressed up with nowhere to go. Naval historians call that a fleet in being, as opposed to a fleet that you actually go out and use. It's a lot like saving your closer for a lead when you have a tie game on the road. You don't really have a closer at that point, for the simple reason that a pitcher you never use is not actually a pitcher. He's not anything. He doesn't exist. But on this particular day, they decided they would draw the British into a trap, and they sailed out from their ports into the North Sea, and the British had cracked their code, so the British were right on top of them. And I'm not going to give you the whole order of battle, but the key thing here, in terms of our point of view, in terms of pitcher usage in the World Series, is that both sides had something called battle cruisers. In addition to these giant, kind of Titanic-style battleships, they had what were supposed to be fast battleships, which is basically a battleship with much lighter armor, so that it could speed along a little bit. These would be like your first wave in a big naval battle. They would zip in, pop, 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 and zip out, and then your big battleships, your dreadnoughts, would be like your closers, and they would finish the job. This turned out to be flawed thinking on both sides, because in an era in which you are, as I said, lobbing these high explosives from miles out, you need the armor. You need it all over the place. In the old days, you had to armor the ship in the middle or at the waterline, because if you know your pirate movies or anything else where you see old wooden ships broadsiding each other, they're firing kind of side to side. Well, now you're firing up in the air and the shells are coming straight down on you. So you've got to armor the deck. But it can happen the other way, too, the old way, so you've got to armor the side. You've got submarines, so you've got to armor under the waterline. Essentially, you can't skimp on that. Well, they did. And there was one aspect of this that the Germans figured out much faster than the British, which is, when you have these turrets, you also have to have ammunition. And the way that's set up is you have a magazine. That's, for those who are not familiar with the term of art, that's not Time or Life or Newsweek or anything. That's where they store the shells. And you have an elevator that carries those from the belly of the ship up to the guns. An elevator shaft is a really good way to conduct flaming debris from the top of something to the bottom. It can just fall down. And the Germans figured this out and were disciplined about installing ways to keep that elevator shaft shut when it wasn't in use. So, if a bomb burst on the top of the ship, debris would not tumble down into the belly of the ship and ignite the magazine. This is how the Death Star scene in Star Wars works, except it's an unshielded exhaust port. It's the same idea. This is an unshielded magazine. The British didn't want to sacrifice their gunnery speed. to closing up that elevator shaft, and so they more or less kept it open. Again, the theory was you armor the ships and they can take a pounding and give that pounding back. That's not how it worked in practice for the British. And this is one of the most famous lines in military history, and it's funny but also sad, in that they engage the battle, and one of the British admirals commanding the battlecruiser fleet is a guy named David Beatty. And as he sends in those battlecruisers, the Germans start shooting. And when the shells come down, flaming debris goes down into the bellies of those ships. The magazine catches. There's cordite everywhere. And those ships just explode with great loss of life. The British had over 6,000 sailors killed that day, some on ships with crews of over 1,000, of which they maybe managed to rescue 20. And that's because those ships just went up like firecrackers. There's David Beatty on his command ship looking around him as his ships are just exploding. And he turns to the captain of his flagship and he says, "Bob, there seems to be something wrong with our bloody ships today." He was right, but he was wrong about today. It was all days because their engineering and practice was flawed. That's how I'm going to remember this World Series, with David Roberts turning to Rick Honeycutt and saying, "There seems to be something wrong with our bloody pitchers today." But maybe, as with those battlecruisers, it wasn't that there was something wrong with the pitchers, there was something wrong with the ball, there was something wrong with when and how they were deployed, either too late or too early or too long. Or maybe it was just one of those things. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. You always had an irrational fear of the store closing early, and when you heard the public address system say, "The time is now 9 o'clock, please bring your final purchases to the register," you would begin to panic and beg your parents to leave the store. Somehow, you had gotten the idea that once they locked the doors and turned out the lights, that the aisles were patrolled by wolves. As you got older, you realized that this was pure craziness and no longer had that fear, even if you were in the store right up until the moment of closing. But then, one day, perusing the plastic storage bin aisle in a chain store that our lawyers tell us we cannot mention, you linger not only past the closing announcement, but somehow right past the moment the employees turn off the lights, lock the doors, and go home. As the lights switch off, that old panic grabs you again, and you begin frantically to search for an exit, but you cannot find one. And that's when you hear the shuffling, almost a slithering, and a hiss, and a flicking of tongues. And you realize, of course your childhood fear was ridiculous. They don't patrol the aisles of the store with wolves. They patrol them with Komodo dragons. And belatedly, you realize you should have stayed home and done your shopping online. In episode 28, all major credit cards accepted. Welcome back to the show, episode number 28. I can't believe that I've now completed 7 months of doing this, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. This has been very different for me and my career, a chance not just to speak to you through black and white print, but to talk to you directly and to have you know what I'm about a little bit and to get to know some of you via infiniteinning@gmail.com or Twitter or smoke signals or jungle drums. I'm not particular. And I aim to keep being here on our increasingly erratic schedule. It's still weekly. Haven't missed one yet. Keep missing my hours. And now that all the postseason stuff is done with and I don't have a regular gig at the moment, although I will be seeking one out, I will try to get the schedule back under control, get us reliably back on Wednesdays. Might be Fridays for a while going forward. That's where things are right now, and I do appreciate your patience. In the meantime, to facilitate that communication, I think I'm going to open up a Facebook group for the show, and I can post updates about the show, especially when I'm flailing at delivery, as I have the last few weeks. If you listen to Mark Maron, who I greatly enjoy, he always talks about how you have to be reliable. And as an editor, I've always talked about that, too, that you have to habituate people, just like television, although that's breaking down some with the DVRing of everything and the binge-watching of everything, but it used to be that you knew that if you wanted to watch a certain show, you had to watch it Tuesdays at 8 o'clock. And I think web content is that way, too. You have to know that it's going to be there Tuesday at 8 o'clock, and people will come back that way. And one simple solution for me, which has been suggested repeatedly, would be to cut the length of the show, tell one story per show instead of two, or have a half an hour interview instead of an hour interview. But you guys seem to enjoy the format as it is now, and I kind of enjoy it. I don't enjoy what comes after, the production end of it. Nonetheless, I'm going to stick with the way things are for now. On today's show, I'm joined by author Paul Dixon, who has written many, many books, as we'll discuss in the interview. But today's talk is primarily about his newest book, Leo Durocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son. In case you came to class without doing the required reading, suffice it to say that Leo was the guy who sort of kind of said, nice guys finish last. It's not exactly what he said, but it got kind of edited and condensed over time so that it's what he said. He tried very hard, successfully, not to be a nice man. Or was he successful? That's an interesting question. He certainly won a lot, and he went to the Hall of Fame. But after his death, in part because that lack of niceness encouraged people who then had power over him in the form of the Veterans Committee to want to punish him unto death. And the question that results from all that, we know he wasn't a nice guy, but was he a good guy? That's where I pick up with Paul and Leo Durocher's 100% controversial career as a player and manager. We didn't even scratch the surface of the number of controversies that Leo was involved with in his career. Before we leave behind what was for me an exciting but exhausting World Series, one quick note on the legend of Roger Peckinpah, error-prone shortstop. He does and doesn't deserve that, and that's kind of my point here. There were 28 errors made in this postseason, 13 by third baseman, the rest scattered all over the place. Maybe I'm extra sensitive to this, but it seemed to me like every time an error was made, the name Roger Peckinpah would be invoked. Peckinpah is a legend for the 1925 World Series when he was the shortstop for the Washington Senators, and he's the reason that the MVP awards are now after the postseason. As is famously the case, Peckinpah was, sort of weirdly, voted the 1925 MVP. He didn't hit much. It was purely a glove and leadership award. And then he went into the World Series. It was the Washington Senators, now the Minnesota Twins, against the Pittsburgh Pirates, now the Pittsburgh Pirates. The Senators were defending world champions, but Peckinpah made 8 errors in the series, a record, including 2 in Game 7. And although he also hit a home run in that game, his miscue in the bottom of the 8th took a 7-6 Senators lead and turned it into a 9-7 Pirates lead, which was indeed the final score. What bugs me about that story is that when broadcasters cite it in the postseason, it's always about a player unexpectedly falling apart under World Series pressure. And there is some of that, except for the part about unexpectedly. Because if you're familiar with Peckinpah's story, this was actually his second World Series GOAT appearance. He was the starting shortstop on the 1921 Yankees as well, the first Yankees team to go to the World Series. He was a very good player in a lot of ways, a decent hitter for a shortstop of his day, and outside of October, he was a pretty good defender too. In the heart of his career from 1914 to 1925, there were really no shortstops who were huge offensive contributors for most of that time. By the time he was done, Joe Sewell, Glenn Wright, Charlie Holliker, the latter two not well remembered, and we should talk about them one of these days, but those guys were hitting quite a bit. But in terms of his day, it was Dave Bancroft and Art Fletcher, both giant shortstops, then Rabbit Marinville and him. None of them was Cal Ripken. The 21 World Series, though, was a disaster for the Yankees, and he was a big part of that. The bigger part was that Babe Ruth got hurt and couldn't play in the last few games. He coached third, which is kind of cool to think about, as if Mike Trout, while he was on the DL this year, just kind of took himself out to the box and waved runners home with his bandaged thumb. Today, that would put pressure on a player in all the wrong ways. You can fire a third base coach who runs players into too many outs at the plate, but you can't fire Mike Trout. This was the last of the 9-game World Series. Peckinpah was terrible. He hit 179 in 8 games, 5 for 28. He only made one error, not 8, one. But it was a big deal. By the time of Game 8, the Giants were up 4-3, so either the Yankees won to force a Game 9 or it was all over. This was undoubtedly galling to them because they had been up 2-0 and 3-1, and they hadn't even allowed a run in the first 2 games. It was their series. If you look at that team, if you look at its baseball reference page, you can see that if you subtract Babe Ruth from it, there's pretty much nothing there, a 0 offense with pretty good pitching. So it was a big deal for him to be out, as you might expect. It was Babe Ruth at his peak, after all. So the game is Wait Hoyt, the Brooklyn schoolboy, against Art Neff, whose name sounds like a dog sneezing, but he was a tough lefty. Hoyt allowed 6 hits and 1 run. His 1 run came in the first. Neff allowed 4 hits and no runs, a shutout. Normally you'd just tip your cap there. But here's the way the run scored. There were 2 outs. Dave Bancroft and Ross Youngs were on first and second, both having walked. George Kelly came to the bat. Note, by the way, that almost everybody in this story is a Hall of Famer because Frankie Frisch, who also batted in this inning, got to be in charge of the Veterans Committee and inducted everyone he ever played with. Kelly bounced a slow grounder to short, and that should have been the inning, but somehow it got between Peckinpah's legs and rolled through them into short left field. The New York Times Herald Tribune wrote, "Peck's nether limbs looked so far apart at that moment that a regiment could have marched through 4 abreast without touching either side." And then, this is worse, he froze. He didn't go after the ball. He just kind of stood there, and that allowed Bancroft to score from second on what should have been a one-base error. I would really like to see a World Series finish the way that the 9th inning of that game finished. First of all, Ruth pinch hit for Wally Pipp. That was Wally's destiny, to yield to greater men. To lead off the bottom of the inning, his elbow, which was damaged, was all bandaged up. He grounded out. He couldn't hit. But then Aaron Ward walked, and that brought up home run Baker. And if you look at the box score, it just says that Baker hit into a double play. World Series over. So you can imagine it. He's a left-handed hitter, so 4-6-3. Maybe he hit it the other way, 6-4-3. We can pretend 3-4-3, whatever you want, really. But it was a lot more complicated than that. It was the rare 4-3-5 double play. See, it was a 3-2 count on Baker. So Ward is off with the pitch. Baker rips it into the hole between first and second. The second baseman, Johnny Rawlings, makes a diving stop on it and pops up, throwing to first just in time to get Baker. Now, Ward would have been safe at second since he was off with the pitch, but once he hits second, he just keeps on going. And George Kelly wasn't much of a hitter for a first baseman of the day or any day, but he was a really good fielder, good enough to play second base for a year at mid-career, and he whips it across to Frisch at third base, who dives into the base runner, and when the smoke clears, there's Frisch holding the ball, Ward is out, World Series over, and I would argue that although it's not as well remembered, this is as weird as Babe Ruth ending the 26 World Series on a caught stealing. The headlines the next morning said things like, "Peck's error beats Hoyt. Hoyt didn't lose. Good old Peck squashed Yankees. Kelly's roller reveals Peck's bowed legs." This was the team captain, by the way. This is one of the most veteran Yankees. He wasn't that old, but he came up at 19, so he'd been there forever. He was one of the few guys who actually were there longer than the current ownership of Rupert and Houston, the two colonels. He was an institution. He'd even managed the team briefly when he was just a kid because they'd run out of other candidates. Some really good things had happened in that World Series. Wade Hoyt was only 21, but if they had given out World Series MVPs back then, he might have won it even with his team losing. He pitched 3 complete games, allowed 2 runs, none earned. In the clubhouse after the game, Hoyt kept it together as Ruth and Peckinpah and others came up to him and congratulated him on a great start. But when the co-owner, Till Houston, came to shake his hand, both began to weep. After that game, Giants manager John McGraw said, "In World Series, usually one team cracks at some stage under the terrific strain, but nothing of the sort happened in this one. All of the players on both clubs acted as if they had been through World Series without number. They played steadily at all times and were awake to every situation." Okay, well, Yankees ownership and Miller Huggins, their manager, didn't feel that way. And there's an extra dimension to Huggins' pain because there's a lot of second-guessing of him after the Yankees lose. And Babe Ruth, in particular, is saying that Huggins should be fired and Peckinpah should take over for him. So you have 3 or 4 things going on at once. You have a 1-run loss in a clinching game. You've made both your team's best young pitcher and your co-owner cry. You are being associated with a putsch against the manager, and those owners don't have any loyalty to you. In fact, as they would demonstrate time and time again in the ensuing decades, their only loyalty was to making money and winning. And so, on December 20th of that year, Peckinpah was traded with 3 other players and $100,000 to the Red Sox for 2 good starting pitchers, Bullet Joe Bush and Sad Sam Jones, and a steadier shortstop, Everett Scott. This was another of those Harry Frazee trades meant to annoy American League president Ban Johnson. Notified of the trade, he called Frazee the champion wrecker of the baseball age. Or maybe it's the champion wrecker of the baseball age. I'm not really sure. You can kind of inflect it either way, and it still makes sense. Peckinpah was stunned. He found out about the trade from the newspapers, and he said, "It seems that no matter how good a player one is or how much loyal service he gives the New York team, his position is never safe." He was angry that he was going from the Yankees, a World Series team, to the Red Sox, who wouldn't get to a World Series again until 1946. He never played for them, though. They immediately flipped him to the Senators for jumping Joe Dugan, who would also be a Yankee before the season was out, but that's another story. And that's how Peckinpah got in the position of messing up the 25 World Series. And there's no great takeaway here, except that when you bring up Peckinpah, it's important to note this was the second World Series he had had problems in. And again, there's a big difference between 8 errors and 1 error, except for one key fact, I think, which is that when the ball went through his legs, he gave up on it. He just stood there. He vapor locked. And that allowed a runner to score from second base on a ball that was right behind him. That says something about unexpected, and it says something, and it suggests that maybe we should be a little bit more charitable about Roger Peckinpah and perhaps what his emotional state was at these times. Maybe there was more going on than just World Series pressure. It's easy to call someone a goat, but harder to empathize when they may be suffering from anxiety or some other distraction that we can't know about at this late date. To borrow from the poet Allen Ginsberg, sometimes instead of condemning people, we just need to have a little patience and generosity. I'll be back with Paul Dixon in just a moment. Paul Dixon is the author or co-author of over 60 books. His baseball dictionary and baseball quotation books are essential references. As the winner of Sabre's Henry Chadwick Award, he's been recognized as one of the great baseball historians of all time. His latest book, Leo Durocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son, is the most thorough biography of one of baseball's most controversial figures. I'm honored to have him join me now. How are you, Paul?
Good, Steve. How are you?
You know, I'm well. Before we get to Leo Durocher, your productivity shames me and most every working writer out there. I was struck by the fact that the author's page of your book makes a point of saying post-millennial works only, and that lists over 24 books. And these are not quickies or knockoffs. The Leo book is filled with footnotes that testify to how much research you've done. And I would like to know, just so maybe I can feel better about myself or learn something, how you keep up such a great level of productivity?
It's a good question, because there's several answers, one of which is protecting a life without a job. In other words, the last job I had, the last paycheck I got from on a legitimate basis, in other words, I've done some consulting, but the last real paycheck I got was in 1968, and the last paid vacation was in 1968. And so I've been doing this all my life. And so a lot of it is coming up with ideas which are both commercial and ones I really, really want to do, which is a thin line sometimes. But being productive is, I mean, that's all I do. I mean, I've raised kids. I've take out the trash and I write. You know, it's a pretty absorbing piece of my life. And the other thing is, I just love narrative. I just love getting into a subject and letting it just sort of take over. And once that happens, it's a lot easier than getting up and going to a job cutting people's hair in a barbershop.
That's true, but it must have taken a leap of faith even then to say that you were going to cut loose from that kind of structure, from the regular paycheck, and just be writing every day. And then just the goals that you must have to set for yourself, because first of all, some people will take 10 years to write a book. And I don't want to imply that those people are self-indulgent. Maybe sometimes they have a reason to take 10 years to write a book. And then others will say, you know, I've done 1,500 words today. That's enough for me. I'm done. I'm going to spend the rest of the day on the sofa. But it doesn't seem like either is an option for you.
No, and I, you know, it's part of it is I always wanted to do this. In other words, from the time I was a kid, I wanted to be a freelance writer, an independent writer, and not have to worry about going to meetings and going to offices and the whole thing. So it was already sort of in my self-created DNA to want to do this. And And that made a big difference because I kept looking at my whole, you know, I started in the Navy. The first time I really started selling stuff to newspapers and magazines was when I was in the Navy. And I just, all of a sudden, it just occurred to me that coming out of the Navy, I had a job as a reporter for a couple of years, but the goal was always to be a book writer and a person who wrote for magazines and a person who got paid to write. And so that became sort of its own goal. And it's become harder and harder to do that. Some of the old outlets are gone, and a lot of the new outlets, which are blogs and things like that, don't pay. You're in a new sort of universe. Wanting to do it for a long, since you're a kid, is a big deal.
To spend one more second on this, I was going to say exactly what you just said. Given the span of your career, when you look at writers who are contemporaries of yours, and you look at the kind of magazines that they published in back in those days, there were men's magazines that took nonfiction accounts of things and also short stories. And by men's magazines, I don't necessarily mean Playboy, but literally oriented towards men, things that had words like adventure in the title.
The great example of that was True Magazine, and that was basically narrative nonfiction. I mean, they occasionally ran a fiction piece, but you'd have these odd off-the-wall magazines, and they'd be running really hot, high-end fiction and nonfiction, so you could get away with a lot of stuff like that. And, you know, the magazines paid really well, and for a while there were a couple of magazines where actually you'd give me an advance. There was one magazine in New York that I was doing a lot of work for, Town and Country, which is one of the ones that are still out there. And Town and Country, there was an editor there. I literally, when I needed some money, I'd call him up and he'd send me $2,000 as an advance against my next piece. And so, you know, it was a different system. And it was, I mean, for all the things that the internet has done that are good, there's also things that it's done that have sort of disturbed the market. First, things like writing. That writing, everybody now can start their own blog or, you know, run a huge op-ed at, you know, on their own and such. Which before was sort of, there was a fence around all that. And even some of the big name online things don't pay.
Right.
They're just that, you know, you do something to get it off your chest.
Turning to Leo Durocher, he was a key figure in baseball for roughly 50 years. He was Miller Huggins' protege on the great Yankees teams in the late 20s. He was a leader of the World Series winning Gas House Gang with the Cardinals in the 30s. He named them the Gas House Gang, at least in some accounts. As a manager, he helped revive baseball in Brooklyn after that team was at the bottom of the standings and broke for nearly 20 years at the point that he took over. And he led the New York Giants to an upset victory over the Cleveland Indians in the 1954 World Series, a team that had won 111 games. And that little accounting doesn't really summarize everything that he did or was involved with, which, as you said in the book, he had a Zelig-like quality for turning up virtually everywhere. And yet, despite that resume, and having read your book and read many other things about Leo over the years, because if you're a baseball historian, you can't escape him, really, I find it difficult to make my mind up about him. I know he wasn't a nice guy. The nice guys were the people he looked down on. But was he a good guy?
Yeah, I still wrestle with that. And people have asked me what I thought. I said this, the way I put it was a metaphor of being on an airplane. And I'm sitting on an airplane. I've got a ticket to first class. And this is all, you know, hypothetical. And the flight attendant brings Leo Durocher to sit down next to me for, you know, say a coast-to-coast trip. And I'd probably ask him to tour economy class. I'd probably get out of the seat. I think he could be insufferably bully-like. I think he couldn't stand. I mean, I think the worst mark against him, I think, was the fact that he could not stand anybody who had a greater share of the spotlight with Leo than Leo. So his attacks, which I think is the saddest point of the book, is where he just goes after Ernie Banks. But he can't stand Kaya Cobb as a rookie. He basically, everything he can do to sort of degrade Ty Cobb. He does everything he can to degrade Ruth. All of his life he does anything he can to sort of put Ruth in a bad light. Once he helps bring Jackie Robinson up to the majors, the next year when he comes back to baseball, he gets suspended at the very same moment that Robinson comes up. He basically picks fights with Robinson, and they hate each other for years, and then sort of make up at the, you know, years later. But he couldn't stand the fact that anybody sort of was more beloved. Ron Santo was another one who he just hated because Santo was so popular. So you go to the time with the Cubs, and here's a guy that really, I think, really caused the Cubs to not win and finally in 69, even though they had that great advantage, and the Mets overtook them. And I think Leo did everything wrong. He berated his players. If a player told him he wasn't feeling well, he wouldn't let the player out of the game. He punished him by keeping him in the game. He took off and lied about it, took off a couple times during a game, once to go to his stepson's camp in Wisconsin, but said to everybody he's going home sick. And so he did these things to demoralize that team. So when there's a clubhouse revolt in 70, and Santo tries to kill him, and he's had another clubhouse revolt in 43 in Brooklyn. So he's the only manager in history who's had more than one club. No, nobody else has had a clubhouse revolt. He's had two. And so you see this guy who's just, and he's got these other real faults, and he just never can. It's very hard for him to tell the truth. His own biography just makes up this nonsense autobiography, and he's clearly a compulsive gambler. He can't shake it. That's why his fourth wife, left him. She just said, when I married him, he promised to give up gambling, and he's just too sick. He can't stop. So he's this immensely flawed guy. He's a tough, you know, if you're a big star, if you're a Sinatra, or if you're one of the Spencer Tracy or Hollywood people, Jackie Gleason, he loves those people and they love him. But when he gets to baseball, it's a whole other world for him. He doesn't mind hanging around with Sinatra because Sinatra is sort of he's in a different ring of the circus. And he's got, you know, it's sort of fine with him to be with DeRocher, but not with Babe Ruth, say, or Ernie Banks. So I guess I don't like him. And it took me a long way to come to that. I kept trying to say, well, let's look at the other side. I was trying to be as fair as I could as a biographer. But I came at the end of him. I did not like him, and I did not admire him. I respected the fact that he had certain skills, which were unbeatable. And I also saw the fact that he had been redeemed by several really wonderful people along the way who he could have been just totally wiped out of baseball, except for Branch Rickey and a guy named Sidney Weil, who was his owner when he was in Cincinnati with the Reds.
This quality of his, that he has to be the biggest man in the room, which is fascinating on a number of levels, because first of all, as a player, he was a very skilled player, but he was clearly a complimentary player. He was, as Babe Ruth said, the All-American out. He was just not a very good hitter. He was, by reputation, an exemplary fielder, but he wasn't the guy who was the all-around star like Ty Cobb, like Babe Ruth, and yet he had the ego of that player and wanted to be compensated like that player and resented the guys who actually did have that skill level. One of the more shocking moments in the book and in any recounting of Leo's story is the moment in 1938 when Larry McPhail brings in Babe Ruth to coach first base for the Dodgers and essentially make batting practice a thing that you wanted to buy a ticket to because he would hit home runs during batting practice. But when he and Leo get in an argument over whether Ruth flashed a hit and run sign on a play that led to a game-winning hit, and you have this image in the book of DeRocher actually slapping Ruth in the face, just disciplining him as if he were this recalcitrant child, and it's like reading about somebody slapping George Washington apple pie and mom. It's a terrible, terrible thing. And as you said, he feuded with Ruth going back to when they were teammates. But at the end of your book, you quote an interview with DeRocher where someone visited DeRocher at his apartment where he was living, or his house in Palm Springs. And on the wall is the picture of him and Ruth. It's reproduced in your book of Ruth with his arm around DeRocher. And it seemed to me psychologically a very strange thing for him to have that picture in a place of honor. And I couldn't really decide what it said about DeRocher that he had it there.
You know, you make a fascinating point. But I'm not sure, knowing Leo, I'm not sure somebody just didn't bring it to his house and he hung it up. I mean, I'm not sure it was a major piece of, you know, sort of psychological reconciliation with Ruth. Because he knew, and of course he suffered from the whole business with Ruth. Ruth alleging after a while that he had stolen his watch. Ruth went to his death believing that Leo had stolen the watch. But I think the other thing is to try to unravel it. You realize what I think one of the things I showed in the book, which I don't think anyone's ever pointed out before, that the extent to which the Yankees, the original, when he comes up with the Yankees, the degree to which that team hated him, and that team hated him to the degree that they were actually in pennant race times, they were actually throwing balls short to Leo so he'd screw up. They hated him to that degree, and that was up and down on that team. And the one exception was the manager, Miller Huggins, who saw him as this really spark plug player who basically kowtowed to Huggins. But the other players really, really hated him. And that, you know, it comes through and you say, well, what did it take? And it was the arrogance. It was the, you know, he stages right before, he's only played in 12 games, and these gangster friends of his, well, they're not gangster, but more bookies and that kind of, not gangster, but people outside the law, stage a Leo DeRocher day at Yankee Stadium. And Ruth hasn't had a DeRocher day. Gehrig hasn't had a Gehrig day. I mean, you know, and it's partly just he could go through, he could get so many people hating him. And one of the things you find when you fast forward to the Cubs many years later, the degree to which those guys really ended up hating him, his own team. And the other teams were actually do anything to beat the Cubs. They were that difficult to deal with under DeRocher. It's a very interesting thing. And then, of course, he gets in the Hall of Fame, but you realize the breadth of it all. I mean, and even the suspension. I mean, the suspension, which is, you know, he gets suspended from baseball for a year. And nobody really at the end knows all the factors that positively led to that. And I think the major factor was a letter which was sent to the commissioner from Frank Murphy, a Supreme Court justice, who said DeRocher's got to be taken out of the game. I mean, I have a Supreme Court justice write to the commissioner to say this man has to be removed from baseball. People didn't believe me when I first said, talked about this. They said, what do you mean? You're making this up. I said, no, I'm not. It was that his persona was that big at that time.
Well, you have to either accept that he was thrown out of baseball for a year for marrying Lorraine Day and basically kind of sneaking her out from under her then current husband and marrying her very, very quickly, which offended the Catholic population of Brooklyn or nationally in general, or that it was his association with George Raft, or that it was the fact that there were some bookies and a box in Cuba. It gets very complicated, and yet there's no smoking gun. There's no one thing that seems to have motivated it, except that Happy Chandler, the commissioner, just really, really didn't like him.
And one of the reasons Chandler hated him, and this is a thing that actually amazed me, because when I found it, Chandler had been governor of Kentucky. And across the river from Kentucky is Cincinnati. DeRocher, being the compulsive gambler, spent a lot of his time in Kentucky, where there were some sin cities where you could go and gamble any time of the day or night, right across the river from Cincinnati in Kentucky. As governor of Kentucky, he knew who DeRocher was. And the thing that bothered him the most was that DeRocher brought his mother from Springfield, Massachusetts, to Cincinnati to work as a chambermaid in a hotel. And in fact, his first divorce, his mother was a witness in the first divorce hearings. She'd spied Leo's first wife in bed with another man and testified to that in court. Chandler couldn't get over the fact that here's a guy making really good money as a member of the Cincinnati Reds, and he brings his mother to Cincinnati so she can work in a hotel as a chambermaid. And that really bothered me. It violated his whole sense of sort of being a gentleman and being, you know, a supporting son and all that stuff. And so it's an odd mix. It's like, you know, a match and gasoline to put those two guys in the same room. But I think that the thing about the Murphy letter, which is really, really interesting to me, was the degree to which somebody of that stature couldn't get involved. And when the final hearing is held about whether or not they're going to they're going to suspend DeRocher. Chandler pulls a letter out of his pocket and says, holds it up in the air and says, there's pressure from Washington to get rid of him, and then shoves it back in his pocket. And for years, people believed that the letter was from J. Edgar Hoover. They just assumed it was from J. Edgar Hoover because they assumed that J. Edgar Hoover had found some kind of gambling connection or something that was outside the law. But it was really from Frank Murphy, who's this very devout Catholic member of the Supreme Court. So it would be like Ruth Bader Ginsburg sending a letter about about Dusty Baker being fired by the Angels. You know, these are the puzzles don't fit. But that's what makes it a great narrative. Not my narrative, but the narrative itself of his life.
I was struck by that story, the chambermaid story, because it really, I don't know if it's a reason for him to be suspended from baseball, but it doesn't speak well of him necessarily. And yet, I also felt he was kind of helpless where money was concerned. There's a great quote from him in the book that he needed to win the 1934 World Series and get the winner's share instead of the loser's share because, and I think I have this right, he said, I needed to make $6,000 instead of $4,000 because I owed $8,000. I guess it was the compulsive gambling more than anything else, but he also seems not to have been able to resist buying cars and buying clothes and was unable constitutionally to keep himself on any kind of budget at all.
Yeah, and he basically, the women that he marries, is taking out, forgetting the first wife, was sort of a shadow, but the women that he married were basically smarter than he was, in many ways more successful than he was, and in some cases in different realms, even more famous than he was, namely Lorraine Day. But and the women tended to be better business people, almost every one of them, well, every one of them except for the first, and basically put him on budgets and such. So he kept being saved by these people. When Sidney Weill gets him in Cincinnati, he basically takes over his finances. And same thing with Branch Rickey. They take over. They say, "Oh, we're gonna keep you from buying all this stuff and running up credit." But in the wake of all this, he was stiffing all sorts of people along the way. I mean, and they'd be, you know, tailors and small business guys. And so he was. It wasn't just like he was trying, you know, stiffing the phone company. It was stiffing these guys, you know, who needed the money for the work they did for him.
Before I ask you about one other negative quality of his, which is his compulsive dishonesty, I also want to point out that what negates a whole lot of this for me, beyond the fact that he was a very canny manager at times when he was engaged, as opposed to, say, with the 69 Cubs, where, as you pointed out, he just left the club on a couple of occasions, which even today is just very, very hard to believe that so dedicated a baseball man, so a guy who was so obsessed with winning would do something like that. He was also integral to the process of desegregating the major leagues. He was, up to the moment of that suspension in 47, the manager of the Dodgers when Jackie Robinson was being brought to the majors, quite famously when Dixie Walker and other Southern-oriented Dodgers players staged a rebellion, circulated a petition saying they wouldn't play with Jackie. DeRocher had a meeting in which he said, "I don't care if he's black, white, or striped like a bleeping zebra, he's going to play and you'd better get used to it." And then that scenario kind of repeated itself with Willie Mays, Monty Irvin, and players like that on the New York Giants, and Willie Mays looked up at him as a father. And when you read about DeRocher's relationship with Mays, it was almost tender. To me, that balances a great deal of other misdoings in other parts of his life.
No, I agree. I think the highest point in his life is when he gets to the Giants. They integrate the Giants with Henry Thompson and
Irvin?
Yeah. This is before Mays comes up. He understands that these guys are different. These guys are, they've both been in World War II. Irvin has been in the Normandy invasion in the fourth or fifth day. Thompson's been in the Battle of the Bulge. These guys have both seen the worst parts of World War II in terms of fatalities and all the gruesomeness of it, horror of it. And he realizes, I think at this point, that he can't badger them like some kid from some small town in Georgia or something. You know, he can't treat them like real rookies. He's got to treat them. These guys have been in combat, and they're not going to breach anything from him, you know, that they can't stand and or won't stand for. And I think he changes, and that sets him up for Mays. And he realizes he's putting together this enormously fantastic team. and he realizes it's dependent on these black guys. And he's totally colorblind because he's been brought up, the guy that pushes him into baseball in the first place is a black man named David Redd, R-E-D-D. David Redd is a guy he worked with in a factory in Massachusetts. And for the rest of his life, or most of the rest of his life, DeRocher every year gets David Redd World Series tickets, whatever David Redd wants. He continues to honor him throughout his life. So this is the great oasis of goodness in his life. And I think that team, I think, you know, I interviewed Monty Irvin several times about DeRocher, and he, just like Willie Mays, could not say a single thing negative about DeRocher. You'd ask him, you'd even ask him a leading question, like, you know, about gambling or something. He's, oh, yeah, yeah, we used to love to play poker in the clubhouse. Yeah, but it was only for a penny a game or something. You know, it was like nothing you could bring up would cause Monty Irvin, who is a very, very smart man and very astute and very worldly, to get him to say anything negative about DeRocher. And I think that whole colorblindness goes right through his life. But then he encounters Ernie Banks. He decides he's going to do everything he can to get rid of Ernie Banks. And Banks is forced finally to go home to his mother and say, what should I do? This guy's bullying me. He won't leave me alone. He's trying to get rid of me. And his mother says, just turn the other cheek. Just walk away.
Steve here, interrupting for what may be one last commercial break. We'll be back after this word from our sponsors. Let me offer a counterpoint to that, and I don't want to diminish what he did to Banks at all, but in thinking about that Giants team, I think one underappreciated aspect of that, I just mean in general, not necessarily in your book, is that when he went to the Giants were a very different team than the one he ultimately won with. They were called the Window Breakers. They had set a single-season record for home runs the year he took over. Johnny Mize was the big hitter on that team. And he cleaned house to those guys. He was not interested in having this sort of slow-footed, slugging team. He wanted to reorganize that team around versatility and speed and defense. And he did that, and then he was astute enough to recognize who Willie Mays was and what his capabilities were, as opposed to, say, the Red Sox, who sort of insincerely scouted him and said, oh, he's not a real prospect, he can't hit a curveball, that kind of thing. And that's how he put that team together. So part of me wonders if, in addition to the fact that he has to pick fights with the biggest guy on the block, in addition to the fact that he just had some of these irrational dislikes of certain people around him, I just wonder if he saw Banks as an impediment to rebuilding that team along Leo DeRocher lines.
I'd never considered that thought before, but my seat-of-the-pants reaction is no, because he went there when the attendance was low. I mean, all these other things were going on. And the one thing that basically held that team together in terms of this, of a city with two teams and everything else, was Banks. So if for no other reason than just the morale, not moral, but morale of the city, it was the stupidest thing he could have done, because he could still build a team around Banks. There were just so many things he could have. And the other thing is to take on Santo to the point where Santo wants to kill him. And he really decided he hated the fact that Santo was more popular in Chicago than he was. And that drove him crazy. And he finally takes on Santo. Santo's going to have a special day. Santo has got diabetes. Nobody knows this. And he goes to the Wrigley family and says, I want to do a big day to announce the fact that I have diabetes and use the gate from that day to support diabetes research. And Wrigley goes along with it. And DeRocher gets a whiff of this and attacks Santo for having a special day and makes it as if this is Santo's ego. All Santos is doing is basically revealing a fact about himself and trying to use that fact to leverage money for disease research into his disease. And it's almost like you can't imagine a character that evil. Actually, I can, but somebody who would basically see that is their way of dealing with Santo. And, of course, Santo, just who really likes DeRocher at first and finally ends, just really hates him. And I've talked to people who knew Santo, and they just said he couldn't even talk after all. He couldn't even say the guy's name. That's how much that he... And again, Santos was performing beautifully. And you know, Banks kept coming back and performing beautifully.
One of the things that your book does is it serves as a corrective to Nice Guys Finish Last, which is Leo's autobiography with Ed Lynn. Ed Lynn, parenthetically, was just one of the great ghosts, in my opinion. He also did Bill Veeck's book, several yep. others. He was very good at capturing somebody's voice, even if it was just working off of interviews. But the book is really problematic, and I didn't realize until I read yours just how problematic it was. I knew that it skipped certain key incidents that made Leo look bad, like the 1943 Player Rebellion, which is this huge incident, is not mentioned at all, which is immensely frustrating. But I didn't realize the degree to which Leo obscured his childhood, changed details of it, and in general just made it impossible to figure out the origins of some of these psychological quirks that we've been discussing.
I was appalled. What really happened to me was the one story he tells in the book, which was the key into this, was the entry point, where he says when, as a kid, in the winter, he and his buddies would go down to the Connecticut River and skate to Boston and skate up the Charles River and go to the Harvard Boat Club and turn around at the Harvard Boat Club, skate back down the Connecticut River and be home by dinner time. And then I started thinking about the fact, and I got some prodding on this, that the Connecticut River does not go west to east, it goes north to south. And the Charles River comes the other way, and there's no way you could have skated out. I mean, it's a long, long story. But it was totally fabricated. And then he picks up things like, you know, he said he learned to play polo at Springfield College. And I spent all this time on the phone with the PR people at Springfield College, and they never had a polo team. But and then the other one, I mean, the most venal of them is that he goes, and I had people in Springfield working on this stuff. I mean, really detailing the facts as they were. He claims he was thrown out of high school because he beat a teacher, a math teacher, with a window pole. Well, if you're as old as I am, you know a window pole was a large oak pole with a brass top, which you would use to open windows with. And he said he hit him that he beat this teacher with a window pole. Well, that would have been a felony. He would have been, if he had beaten a teacher with a window pole, there would be a police involved, and it would be a lot more than just being expelled from the school. Well, he brags about this. This is to show you that I, you know, even a kid, I was tough and I resisted authority. I hated authority. Well, it's untrue. In fact, he didn't even go to high school. There's no record that he even went to high school. But to create a story about yourself beating a math teacher with a weapon is insane. And it's also this metaphor that he chooses, which is an outright lie, to show his birthright was this disdain for authority, meaning the math teacher. And it goes on and on. I mean, I could have written a whole book rebutting things by the page. And, you know, and the other thing about the book, when you reread it, he spends 6 pages of that book attacking Banks. 6 pages are dedicated to saying Banks, his reputation was false. So if I look at the book now, I see, you know, I see people online discussing things they read in the book. I get a mini migraine. I said, no, that's not true. That's not true. Just because it appeared in the book, which is now regarded as the primary source. But it's, you know, he doesn't even mention his first marriage. He doesn't mention the fact that he had a child by his first marriage. But those are the things he leaves out. But even worse are the errors of commission rather than the errors of omission.
And what's very strange about that is for a guy who put so much book on disliking authority or rebelling against authority, he was subject to certain authorities his whole life, whether serving at the pleasure of Branch Rickey or Larry McPhail, of having to get Happy Chandler's permission to play. Essentially, every time he ran up against authority in his life, he lost. He told Ed Barrow to go fuck himself and ended up being traded away from the Yankees for that. It's something that he brags on, but it's not something that was ever really successful for him.
No, it wasn't. And the two guys, you know, if you go back to Rickey and you go back to Weil, Sidney Weil, that's why the book is called The Prodigal Son. Those guys knew how bad Leo was and how screwed up he was and how he treated women, et cetera, up and down the line. But they always stepped in to save him. Rather than authority figures, they were true father figures. They were the father that said, no matter what you do, Leo, I still love you and I'll still do whatever I can to help you. I think that's what saved him. Those two guys saved him. And Miller Huggins earlier. But Weil does everything to help him and bring him out of it. And what's interesting about both of those guys is Rickey is a devout, observant Methodist who won't even go to the games on Sundays. Weil is an observant Jew. And they're both men of great religiosity in their own lives. And they're both biblically willing to accept the prodigal son. I found those two characters most interesting. because they're both men of, you know, both devout men, who saw redemption in Leo. They thought they could coax out of him his greatest. And again, I don't know of another baseball story that has that level of almost biblical overtone.
At the same time, when he came off suspension, Ricky was ready to be done with him.
Yeah. When he comes off the suspension, almost immediately, they go to spring training, and he's gambling again. And that I found this one memo in, which I don't think anyone had really seen because it was still stapled together in a way that you had to get the staples out. But it was a confidential memo, and as soon as they get to spring training, he's gambling again. And he's already told Ricky that he's not going to gamble anymore. And Mrs. Ricky basically he brags to Mrs. Ricky that he just won all this money in a poker game. But from that point on, he betrayed. Ricky had a meeting with him. They went to discuss stuff. Leo doesn't show up for the meeting. And then Leo just goes into this scheme of disrespect for Ricky, who finally just can't take it anymore.
For me, the 1943 Player Rebellion is really emblematic of everything, and we've been alluding to this throughout the program, of everything that's wrong with Leo that he does to self-destruct. And it's another situation almost like the Chandler story that's a little difficult to explain in a linear way. I guess the shortest version is that he suspended Bobo Newsom, the pitcher, for crossing up a young catcher, Bobby Bregan. He then bragged about it to a reporter. The reporter published the story. Leo denied the story. Several players then threatened to quit. Archie Vaughn, a future Hall of Famer, did in fact walk off the team temporarily at first, then permanently at the end of the year. And there's this bizarre scene in the Dodgers clubhouse where the reporter cross-examines Leo in front of his team. Leo admits that he lied about everything that he said, and they almost have to forfeit a game because no one will play. And I might have screwed up the chronology just a little bit there, but it's just a strange combination of lying, doubling down on lying, then admitting you lied. And really, there was no reason for Ricky to keep him at that moment, and somehow yet he survived with the Dodgers close to another 5 years.
Yeah, and that may have been, there may have been a blind side to Ricky at that point, because there were so many other close calls where, you know, one time he says he can't go to an exhibition game. He said he was sick, and he was actually at the racetrack, and he didn't show up for things and didn't show up for meetings. And he was always pushing Ricky. You know, it was almost like the rebellious teenager who keeps telling his father that he's going to change. He'll stop doing something self-destructive, and then goes out and does it anyhow, and then waits for the father to react. And if the father then pardons him again, then he does it again, and which is exactly what Ricky was doing at that point.
It's a very odd scene to read about, with players almost military style turning in their uniforms rather than playing a game. As you said earlier, it's hard to think of a similar occasion in baseball where a team strikes against its own manager.
And in that case, I mean, it was more than just handing in a uniform. They threw his uniform in his face. And there was a lot of high-level profanity involved in those that hour in which all this was going on. And it's only, I mean, it's only when the umps send in the bat boys and other people to say, look, we got to start this game. And the ironic thing about the game was, it's almost like one of these World War II stories. It's everything at the same time. That was the day that was Bring In a Pound of Fat Day. In other words, the idea was baseball was collecting stuff for the war effort, and apparently kitchen fat, literally rendered fat from a cooking a chicken or something, was being used to produce ammunition. And so any woman who brought in a pound of chicken fat to that game got in free. So I had this huge female audience at that game, and tons of, you know, chicken fat sitting in the lobby or by the front gate of the Dodgers being driven off to an ammunition plant. But it was almost like a film director's paradise, all the chicken fat, and then this clubhouse revolt at the same day. And that's the other thing about the book. What was really fun about the book was trying to capture those periods. You know, the first, when Leo first hits Broadway, and you know, he's, George Raft is a song and dance man, and Leo's hanging around all these bookies and gamblers, and then, you know, moving all the way through up to his time in Houston, which is the beginning of the, you know, right after the post-Apollo, right after the moon landing. And so you have this amazing sort of sweep of history in this one guy's life, and he's part of the whole thing.
I had a funny moment reading the book, because as I was reading the 1920s section, I had the thought, this really sounds like Damon Runyon. And about half a sentence later, you wrote, this is just like Damon Runyon. He really was part of that milieu of, it's almost an alien culture now, but this whole other world of Broadway touts and gamblers and other colorful characters.
And the bookies, even they had Runyon-like names like Memphis Engelberg. And Connie Immerman was the other one. But and those guys, and the bookies, that's the other thing that really threw me was finding out that before Ricky comes aboard, there were bookies sitting in the dugout. And pitchers would come in from the mound because they were afternoon games, and the afternoon races were going on at the Long Island racecourses and Hialeah and every place else. And the pitcher would come in and say, put 10 bucks on so-and-so to win and the fifth in Hialeah. And so the gambling was, not only was it in the clubhouse, and not only was it loaded with these bookies and such, but they were in the dugout during the game, taking bets. It's just amazing to me that all that was going on. And that's how baseball was looking the other way.
Just to balance things out, since we've spent so much time talking about DeRocher as kind of a psychological character, what was it about him that made him a great manager?
I think that he had the courage to change teams. I think he had the courage to play a hunch when nobody else would play that hunch. I think what he kept everybody off balance, all of his fights, probably gave him an advantage over time. And some of them were faux, some of them were very, very real. In fact, they had to change the rules of baseball were changed because Leo was arguing balls and strikes. They finally made it. That's what made it illegal to argue balls and strikes was Leo. He got up there twice in an at-bat and argue a call, and they just had to bring it to an end. I think the genius really occurs when he can come in and clean up a team and really recreate it in his own image, I think, of what a great ball club could be, which included often defense, because that was his great ability as a player, which can never be underwritten. He really was, one of the writers said he was the best shortstop defensive shortstop of the pre-war era, pre-World War II. The other thing was, this was my second baseball biography. My first one was Bill Veeck, and Veeck was everything that DeRocher wasn't. There were probably two more distinctly different people in baseball history. And that's why I actually feel very happy that I found these two guys hadn't been done in recent years and hadn't been done sort of as bigger than life, full bios. And they really were more bios about the 20th century than they were as pure baseball biography. A couple of people said, you don't have enough, there isn't a statistical appendix, and there wasn't this. And I'd say, yeah, but it's really a story about America through the prism of baseball rather than a book about baseball per se, and forget all the other stuff.
You know, when you write a biography, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, the characters that you've spent so much time with, they stay with you. They almost talk to you in a way. I don't mean to make it sound schizophrenic, but just that related things come to mind. And I wrote a book about Casey Stengel some years ago, and ever since then, Casey kind of dwells in my head, and he said so many quotable things, and it was in so many life situations that it's very rare that I can't think is not the right word, they just come unbidden, some Casey Stengel quote or anecdote that might apply to a given situation that I'm in, whether it's baseball or not. And I wonder if there's a comparable ghost of Leo DeRocher who dwells with you now, and what he might say to you on a day-to-day basis.
It's sort of like I did a biography of Mussolini. and Mussolini, Leo doesn't talk to me. Bill Veeck talks to me almost every day, because Bill Veeck prevailed over the most hideous physical problems. He had over 30 amputations in the leg. He was wounded in the war. Everything about Veeck appealed to me. His outlook on life, his ability to deal with unbelievable torture and pain, and that's the kind of person that I would like to be. It's late. I'm 78, so I don't have much time to change. No, that's more it. I'm working on a World War II book now, and I'm realizing the extent to which George Marshall was a genius. And I look upon decisions that are made in other realms, and I say to myself, I've been reading so much about Marshall and also about Patton, but how those two guys saw the war. And this is really about before, what I'm writing about is before the war breaks out. But there are certain people that you get, whose lives you get infinitely involved with, who speak to you, but DeRocher doesn't. He's almost like a crazy uncle in the attic.
I'm very glad you're working on a Marshall book, because there hasn't been, at least to my knowledge, a major biography of Marshall in several decades. I think Forrest Pogue, maybe. That I might be naming the wrong author, but
No, that's right. You're right. No, and it, mine isn't really a bio. It's my book is going to be about the 1940 draft and the maneuvers in 1941 and the fact that we've created a phenomenally unbelievable army before Pearl Harbor. And we've created armored forces. We've created the very forces that will basically go to North Africa, then to Europe, then Sicily, up through the Battle of the Bulge, will have been created before the war. And this is something I've been working on. You're talking about, I've been working on this book since 2005.
Wow.
So I've got a piece of Marshall's life. And one of the most extraordinary things about Marshall, I have a whole chapter about Marshall and others working for the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, which is one of the ways Marshall learns how to deal with large, huge numbers of untrained men. And they take this draft in 1940. They draft over 1 million people in 1940, in early 41, before Pearl Harbor. It's almost a miracle what they do with them. They basically turn them into this extraordinary, high morale, highly mobile fighting force against all odds.
Before we let you go, and you've been very generous with your time, since we are now in the realm out of baseball, I have to ask you about this. You co-authored a book on the Bonus Army, the Bonus Expeditionary Force, which is a fascinating story that I wish were better known. And again, it's yet another story that is very hard to tell concisely. But the short version is that World War I veterans were promised a payment from the government for money or earnings that they would have had in civilian life had they remained. The guys who were not in the army tended to clean up during the war years, whereas the soldiers didn't make very much money at all. The government put off paying for that until 1945, and in 1932, we're at the bottom of the Great Depression. Many of these soldiers are now in their 40s and 50s. They're starving. And almost spontaneously, this march happens on Washington, where these veterans come to town and they stay and they stay and they stay, trying to get payment of the bonus out of Congress. This has passed a couple times, was vetoed by Harding and Coolidge, I believe. And they can't get it done, but they also can't leave or won't leave. And so ultimately, Herbert Hoover calls out the Chief of Staff, General MacArthur, and the army chases these guys out of the city. Depending on what you read, no loss of life or a baby might have died. Well, I take that back. There's a police action beforehand in which two of the veterans are killed. The army itself does not kill anybody. There's some wounds. There may be a baby that died from a gas attack. It's a terrible story in which the government attacks its own ex-soldiers. And I was wondering if there's still relevance of that story today, and if it has anything to say to us about the current political situation. Yeah, I didn't make that one easy. I apologize.
I mean, I think the gist of what happened in that case ultimately was we were at a point in the Depression where it could have sparked a major uprising, and J. Edgar Hoover was then the head of the FBI, believed that may have been in the cards. Patton believed it too. I mean, there were, other people that believed that. And I think what happened was it was prevented because there were two factors. The guy that led the Bonus Army, Walter Waters, was a student of Gandhi, and he was nonviolent. And no matter what happened, they were going to lobby Congress. They were not protesters. They were lobbyists. They felt they were just like DuPont or U.S. Steel. They were going to go to Washington in clean white shirts and neckties and go to meet with their congressman and convince them that they were owed the bonus. And I think the other thing, we had a police chief who was phenomenally brilliant and saw these guys coming in. Instead of building a barricade and driving them out with billy clubs, he built a village for them to live in while they were here.
That was
So you had these two.
Pelham Glassford.
Yeah. And he was brilliant, brilliant man, youngest brigadier general in World War I. So you had this moment in which these two really smart, Waters being uneducated but well self-educated, who basically quoted Gandhi and read the writings of Gandhi, prevented violence, prevented the country from coming apart. And I think what is happening now, if you look at Charlottesville, I've talked to people who were at Charlottesville, you just realize the degree this country needs is level-headed leadership, people who can lead us into just defuse situations rather than make them worse. And I have a friend from Charlottesville, going a little off topic, but it was interesting. The police in Charlottesville were being criticized for their sort of passiveness when all this was going on. And this friend of mine is very close to the situation. A professor from the University of Virginia said the police had no choice. The people who come in to protest the removal of the statue were heavily armed with automatic weapons, automatic pistols, AK-47 style weapons. And they said if the police had done anything, it would have invited a bloodbath. You know, we're at a point in this country, we forget all the tweets and Twitters and all that stuff. We're at a point in this country where the balance between good and evil may be worth to see somewhere there are going to be more level-headed people come in to pull us out of it. It sounds really dire, but your question was a hard one to answer with a funny anecdote like, oh, yeah, I remember Abbott Costello once said, if you ask that question, you get an old man saying what he thinks.
No, I think you answered it very well, and I think you're right. Glassford is, nobody is 100% perfect or 100% consistent in their lives. We've certainly discovered that talking about Leo Durocher today, and Glassford is really the hero of the situation. And then yet, in later years, he went out of his way to praise how Douglas MacArthur handled it, which is an odd thing because the way that MacArthur handled it was 180 degrees from the way that Glassford did. And then the other part that struck me as a parallel or at the same time non-parallel to Charlottesville, and you're right that the police maybe had to stand down to avert a larger bloodbath, is that the Bonus Army was not armed, but people like J. Edgar Hoover were insisting that they were, and that helped provoke the military-style response that really was not necessary in the end.
Dan, don't forget, at the end, I mean, it's Eisenhower who is that, he's MacArthur's chief of staff, and Eisenhower's furious that he disobeys the orders. Hoover had specific orders not to cross, issued through the Secretary of War, but not to cross the Anacostia River Bridge to the camps where these men were all staying, and families were all staying. And Eisenhower even tells them at the last minute, and it appears in the final after-action report, he says, you have specific orders not to cross the bridge. MacArthur says, I can't take orders, written orders, during a combat situation, essentially. And went ahead and it was only because some newspaper guy insisted that he'd be able to get the people out of there before they burned the camps to the ground. So there's all that going on as well.
And he also said, I will not bivouac my troops under the guns of traitors.
Yeah. No, I know. No, American history, one of the things that you find, because I've been writing all my life, but think about the Bonus Army story, and Tom Allen, who I'll see for lunch today, actually. Tom Allen and I, we realized that that was part of the American story. It was the largest single moment of the Depression in which there was a groundswell of public display of public opinion and such. In a manifest form, in the sense of the march on the city. The grand story is not told. We tell our story in a very sweeping generalizations and everything. Whereas if you look at the reality of it, it's much more complex and much more nuanced than we like to kid ourselves. It is. And so as we dumb down things, as Wikipedia conspires against the truth. Yeah, they're the ones that started that anti-baby thing. This thing, the Wikipedia for a long, keep putting this thing back up. Somebody does that. The army killed babies during that thing, and we would put up rebuttals to it, and it would never stick. So in a lot of cases, historical inaccuracy prevails because there are people out there that spend a good part of their lives trying to reshape history through the outlet of Wikipedia.
Well, ideologically, that baby is important, I suppose. And I guess there was one baby who died time-wise in proximity to the gas attack by the army, but it's not clear.
It was well before.
Oh, was it?
We
okay.
Really, yeah, we have a whole, the ironic thing about the Wikipedia thing is, when another, I don't know what version is up now, but they went back with the baby story, they referenced the page in our book where we refute the baby story. So a kid doing a research paper said, aha, here's the footnote from this book. They don't rather go to the footnote. So one of the tricks that the trolls use on Wikipedia is putting in footnotes that dispute what they're saying, but might make the person say, oh, that's really an autobiography. That's a whole other subject. I mean, let me go on someday on Hank Greenberg's, what they've done to Hank Greenberg's Wikipedia.
Well, now I will have to investigate that. I urge people to seek out the Bonus Army book. There have been, by my count, three major works about the Bonus Army, most of them the previous two decades ago. This is the most recent and I think the most comprehensive, and it's an underappreciated episode of American history and a really instructive one because whatever the nuances of it, it is an example of when people stopped listening to each other and lobbed a lot of accusations back and forth about motives and intentions, and it ended up in almost the worst possible place that it could have ended up. And, of course, Leo DeRocher, Baseball's Prodigal Son, is out now. Mr. Dixon, it was a great pleasure and a great honor for me to talk to you, and I really appreciate your spending the time with me.
Great time. Thank you so, so much.
By Anubis's leash, we have reached the end of another episode. You can find Paul Dixon on Twitter at New Definer, N-E-W Definer, as if the man were a dictionary, which he just might be. You can follow me on Twitter at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because if it was Let's All Go to the Lobby Stephen Goldman, I'd have to buy all of you popcorn. We have a sponsor now, but nonetheless, this episode is brought to you by the number two. Just as Leo DeRocher was banned from baseball for all of 1947, our producer has been banned from all of podcasting for the rest of time. Reinstatement contingent on good behavior. Updates to follow. I'm very doubtful. Our theme song, which you are hearing now and have been hearing throughout the episode, was co-authored by myself and Dr. Richard Mooring, who has used his vast brilliance to make millions for others but none for himself. Someday he'll rethink that strategy. It'll be a very good day, and it'll be an even better day when he invites me to buy in. Well, unless they decide that the World Series wasn't quite long enough and bring the two teams back for another 7 or 14 games lasting into January, I'll be back next week with David Roth, and we'll have more tales and discussion from inside the infinite inning.